Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Series 3 of The Legacy Tapes. It's a series podcast exploring how to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and today I'm talking with David Jubb, the Artistic Director at Battersea Arts Centre, where he's been in charge since 2004. Hello, David.
Hello.
Hello. So that's...
Too long?
Well, a really, really long tenure. It's remarkably long, and I was kind of curious about, because most people tend to bugger off after about 10 years, right? And they're like, I'm sick of it, I'm going. And I sort of wondered, because I remember when I started working at Oval House, like I had all of these ideas about what I wanted to leave behind. And then after kind of 5 years, they were really different. And for like three times that, you must have been through a million different thoughts about what you were making.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's no doubt about it, it's too long, and I think... in all honesty, you know, the Grand Hall burnt down, which was an unexpected extra chapter.
Yes.
But you're right. I think you do. Well, I mean, it's worth saying, I think when I started here, I had so little idea of what I was doing. So I think maybe I was also a bit of a slow starter. And I had terrible imposter syndrome and just thought that I was rubbish compared to the last people. I mean, I was.
Do you know, I remember you saying that at something I was at when I was really young.
Right.
Saying something like, well, you know, after Tom Morris, everyone thought I was going to be shit. So.
Yeah. Well, it was true. I
was. No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. It's just impossible to... And I also think that I spent... I suppose a moment of breakthrough was accepting that, but also recognising that I think I... always thought I was going to have to be Tom Morris, or that I was going to have to be Duke Kelly, or I was going to have to be Paul Blackman, you know, that. And actually the reality is, of course, you don't. You can't, you can never be as good as those people, you never will be, but you can be a good version of yourself.
Yeah.
And it did take me quite a few years to, I guess, settle into that and just... And also the organisation, I think every time an artistic director has taken over at the Arts Centre, the organisation is always in crisis in that moment. And not the fault of any previous artistic director, it's just always there's something going down. And when I went down, when I started, there was a funding crisis with the local council going down, and I think in my first 5 months I'd made four or five people redundant. That was like one of the first things I had to do. And so it took a long while, I think, to sort of, I guess, work out what I was trying to do. And also because I'm not a director, so I don't... I'm a producer as an artistic director, so I don't make work. So I think also in a way that maybe takes a little bit more time to sort of start to express your creative ideas through producing. I always love what Jude said about, you know, as a director, she's sort of... The South Bank is her show, and it's 24/7 and all of those different stages, and that's a kind of performance, if you like, as a whole. And I like that idea, and I think it took me a while to get my head around that. So that's my excuse.
I mean, I don't think you need an excuse. That's really interesting, because I think... I don't think I'd ever thought about it like that, because I'm a director first. But actually, yeah, like, if you know what you want to do artistically, then all of the practical stuff, you can be like, well, this is what we need to support this thing. Whereas if actually what you come with is what is the structure or the frame that I need to create to let stuff grow, that's probably a harder ask to start with.
Yeah, I think so. And also, I was a teacher. You know, in terms of my approach to this role, there's lots of other things. I was quite a bad theatre director for a while, and or maybe the work was just way ahead of its time and is still yet to be discovered. But I mainly, a lot of the jobs I did were around facilitation. They were about helping other people's ideas or supporting other people to develop. And I think that in that context, like you say, in a way it just took me longer to work out, okay, well, this is the building, this is the resource, this is what we've got, how do we do that? And I think in theatre... particularly in the arts generally, but I suppose my most familiar territory is in theatre. The hierarchies are so profound, and I think the hierarchies in relation to making work are profound, in the sense that in an organisation where there is limited resource, you know, in this building when I first arrived there were 3 black box theatres, 1 rehearsal space and about £25,000 a year to spend on the programme.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, all the shows and all get all of that resource.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly reasonable when it's you know, an arts organisation and a theatre. Well, at least I thought it was at the time. I think now I look back on it and go, oh, that's actually wrong. That's not right, because mm-hmm. there are all sorts of people who want to be creative, and all sorts of people who want to get access to buildings like this.
Mm.
And if you're prioritising all of your main resources, I mean, we used to have a room here called the Main House, and you get that all over the place, don't you?
Yeah, which is a massively like fucked up hierarchy.
And people
straight
used to
away.
Say the main program. People
yeah.
used to call it the main program,
and then everything else was
everything
the
else
edge.
Was all the edge and all around. Mm. And I think it just took me as also as somebody who kind of came into the organisation who sort of propped that up in a way. In that, you know, I was a producer here before in 1999-2000, so I was kind of part of that hierarchy. And I think it just took me quite a while to start to actually go, no, that's wrong. And I want to try and unpick it. And part of unpicking it was the building. I think one of the first reasons why I accepted a job here and got excited about being here was because of the building. It was this extraordinary kind of warren of different spaces and possibilities. And I think was massively underused.
Mm.
It was sort of the dysfunctional.
Yeah, I remember looking for my graduation, a place to do my graduation show, and someone taking me aside and being like, I hear there are all these cellars under Battersea Arts Centre, go and ask them.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, there was this warren of just stuff that couldn't be, there wasn't the resource to use it.
Yeah, exactly. Or there was stuff in it, or asbestos in it, or, you know, it had become sort of just sort of barren in a way, but actually had so much potential. And so, yeah, I feel like unlocking that and beginning to understand what the possibilities of that were and starting to unpick those hierarchies was part of the journey.
So it's really interesting because you're talking so clearly, and it's not surprising because you're in your Phoenix season, right? So, like, you're talking so clearly about the building as your legacy, as, like, a thing that is the legacy. That's the thing that's been what you've shaped. Was it always... were you always conscious of that, or is that a thing that's grown out of having just rebuilt your most of it?
It definitely wasn't conscious, and the whole notion of being on this chat with you about legacy makes it sound like I'm just about to drop dead.
No, we can also interrogate the fundamental notion of whether we think legacy is a good thing.
Yeah,
because
okay,
it's an ephemeral medium. That's why we all do it.
Yeah, for sure. So I hope that there isn't a David Jubb legacy, and I certainly think the building is not my legacy, because actually the building project itself, in the way that we've gone about it, as you know, has been this kind of very iterative, gradual thing.
Mm-hmm.
That I remember when Nick Starr, who was my chair at the time, was executive director of the National Theatre and was like a pro at Capital Project, somebody who really knew what he was doing, helped me start to think about the building. Because I think he recognised that I was getting more and more interested in the building and the possibilities.
Mm.
And even when I was a producer here, you and I walked up the stairs a moment ago and looked at that little attic room.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a producer here back in 99 doing a sort of supported artist programme with people like Toby Jones and Ridiculousness and Kazuko Hoki, trying to find a space in the building. And and that attic was unused. So unlike the basements that you weren't allowed in, it was the one room that you could get in.
Yeah.
And we kind of... I remember having an amazing intern from America, Abigail, who came here, and she like painted her feet and did footmarks all the way along the attic to this attic room. And it was just like this little room, and it was like a chink of light in a way in what was a more established model or a more established hierarchy that existed within the building. And so actually,
like the secret tower.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I knew instinctively, I suppose, that interest in unwrapping the building was something that was really appealing and really exciting to me, but I also didn't know how to do it. I'd never worked with an architect before, never worked, you know, on a project, and it was brilliant to have Nick Starr, who kind of helped. He put us together with Steve Tompkins from House Tompkins Architects, which was a really great relationship. We first met in the courtyard in 2006, and I had a conversation with him. I was absolutely terrified, because I was like having a conversation with this sort of, you know, big shot architect who knew what they were talking about, and I had no idea. And I, in the conversation with him, was just talking about what we were trying to do here. But I said, I really don't know what I'm doing. I'm making this up as I go along.
Mm.
He said, oh, I ran after my own heart. And it was like a little moment of connection where
mm-hmm.
we thought, well, maybe we could improvise with the idea of changing the building. A little bit like Abigail did with her footprints. It wasn't a... Nobody thought about that. It was just a moment where we thought, actually, let's just open this space up
and see what happens.
Yeah, and I think over the last 10 years, you know, with the Bee's Knees, the children's space downstairs, the spaces that we've opened up, and artists' bedrooms, and all of it's been a scratch. All of it's been about try it and then see how it works. And so, yeah, actually, none of those ideas, I don't think, are mine. I think they're all other people's ideas. I think I'm a producer and a supporter and a facilitator. So it's not. So in a way, I hope if there's a legacy, it's more about a process than a. I'm not sure I agree with the idea of legacy. Full stop. But anyway, if there is a legacy, it's more about the fact that people feel they can change it if they want to change it. So rather than feeling like, oh, that's the main house and that's painted black.
Yeah.
And after your show, we will paint it back to black. Thank you very much. But actually, some of that has gone.
Mm.
And actually, there's a more, you know, the building's more permissive. The systems are a bit more permissive.
Yeah.
Even the structures of the organisation, I think, are a bit more permissive. And I hope that fluidity means that people feel a bit more like... I often feel like architectural projects and building projects feel like they're done to people. It's always very telling that with an architectural project, at the end of it, everyone has to piss off and get out of the way while they take the photos. It's like, people are in the way. Steve and I went to see an amazing architect's work called Lina Babaji in Sao Paulo and Rio, and she did various buildings as part of our research trip. And her buildings, like, they're on stilts so that people gather beneath them. It's like the buildings and people mesh and are connected to each other. And I just so often think that architectural design is so much about the building as an art object in itself, where people are almost in the way of it, rather than actually the building as something which people are inhabit. And so, yeah, that sense of not wanting to do an architectural project where it felt like it was being done to people, but people were in it and helping make the decisions as to what happened.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think quite a lot, like, periodically people ask me to, like, have thoughts for some reason about buildings.
Mm.
And one of the things that the thought I always have is, like, I want the walls to be permeable. Sense of osmosis. And that's really nice, that image of the stilts, so that the people are...
Mm.
Yeah, can just drift in.
Mm, exactly, yeah. You find yourself wandering up the stairs to the building rather than sort of... And the whole rules around back of house and front of house, you know, who's allowed at the back of house, who's allowed at the front. We're just trying to break all that crap down, which I just feel is... It's all based on some sort of hierarchy and some sort of control. And I'm not suggesting that this is some sort of radical anarchic...
utopia.
Yeah, it's not... And there are hierarchies, and there is structure, but it's just trying to, I think, so precious, you think about the first moment that somebody might walk into a space that they don't feel like, well, they just don't know what's in it, and what happens to them in that moment? Is it in that moment, do they feel very corralled or, you know, pushed into a certain position or role, when actually... Perhaps if you push a door down that corridor, I mean, as we came up the stairs, deliberately the whole building is open, and we try to keep it like that so that people, you know, if they do push a door, they might bump into someone and they might start a conversation, rather than saying, you stay in here until 7:30 and then you go and sit in there.
Yeah.
And then you go in.
Have you been to the SNFCC in Athens? So let me get this right. The Stavros Niarchos Foundation Cultural Centre.
Ah, yes.
It's the one that Gabby Trandafis runs. Yeah. And so it's this amazing... It's like, the only way I can explain it is, it's like, if you built the Royal Festival Hall and the National Theatre in the middle of St James's Park.
Mm.
And so the whole thing is kind of built into a hill.
Mm.
So it's this beautiful vista that... is, I mean, there's not a lot of green space in Athens, and kind of people descend on it and have barbecues and colonize and then the program, one of the things that Gabby, the theatre programmer there, has done is she brings the program kind of into this, because the weather's amazing, into this amazing parkland, so there isn't, the art isn't really anything to do with the building necessarily. It's just this magic place of stuff happening. That's really exciting, and it's kind of invisible as a building because it's built into the hillside in a really, really interesting way. And it makes, because a lot of what you've just been saying has kind of made me think about that sense of being in, like being invisible and not being, like you said, I don't want there to be a David Jubb legacy. And one of the things I often think about you, because we come across each other a lot seeing stuff or at Edinburgh, and you're always the person who's like in the corner just watching, kind of skulking in a positive skulking.
Probably me skulking.
And I think that's
very shy. I'm like a very deeply, deeply shy person. So the skulk is partly just hiding.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. God, in Edinburgh, I quite often feel like hiding in any hole well, haven't I?
Yeah, yeah. And theatre bars are the most terrific places in the world. Often, yeah. So, you know,
But I think there's something really precious about people that, about the thing being the thing that helps something get made.
Right.
Without making itself present within it.
Yeah.
And that isn't how we're told people who run organisations are supposed to be, right? You're supposed to have a vision. That's the first thing they ask you on the bloody form, every fucking form. And I'm just really curious what, like, how, you know, that sense of being invisible or being under the radar, is that something that you always came with? Apart from being shy, like shyness as an artistic process.
I think, I don't know. I think my artistic vision is summed up in the words of Bananarama, which is, it's not what you do, it's the way you do it. I think, and that's in a way why I struggle to then have a formal vision that defines a thing or a... You know, it's looking back at the start of my time here. There is absolutely no way I could possibly have had a vision to do what we've done. Maybe somebody could, but I couldn't have done that.
I mean, was it you with a Molotov cocktail?
No, I wasn't in London. It wasn't me. It would have been impossible to do that because I as a producer facilitator, I'm always supporting other people's ideas rather than mine. So I'm not saying I don't have ideas, and sometimes I'll throw things into the mix, but it's absolutely about what inspires me, what gets me excited, what makes me cry is when people are inspiring and they have an idea and you can see the light in their eye and you can see the fire in their belly and you think, let's make that happen. That would be great. And that would make them happy. And they, you know, their happiness. And I it's like the old bloody thing, isn't it, about giving Christmas presents. Getting presents is generally pretty miserable.
Yeah.
Giving presents is the most glorious bloody thing in the world.
Yeah. So
when you get it right and you've thought about it and you've, you know, sometimes you can give crap presents, but you know, when you've really thought about it and you've nailed it and you know it's special to someone, it's got that moment. It's just beyond anything. And for me, that's what connects to the notion of artistic vision is just, it's facilitating and supporting and enabling other people's ideas. And that's why, for me, the notion of process is so important. I think in so many things we focus on, you know, product, even within our education system, which is a bit, you know, blinding obvious thing to say, but, you know, the outcome and the exam and the result and and even the knowledge is prioritised over the pedagogy, over the way that the knowledge was gained, over the way that you found it out, over the way you... And fundamentally, that is not necessarily creating...
It's entirely not useful.
It's entirely not fucking useful because it's creating, you know, creates a super elite who are able to read a book, digest it, and communicate it very quickly. And for the rest of us who struggle with that, and I've always struggled with kind of reading something and being able to sort of then quickly absorb it, who learn through doing, because we all learn when we're toddlers, you know, you don't read a book and go, I can read now.
No.
You know, you learn through failure, you learn through all scratch.
Yeah, my thing is like you stick the thing in your mouth and if it makes you sick, you don't do it again.
Exactly. You fall over and you're constantly looking for feedback because you're constantly looking at your siblings or your parents or your peers or whoever and you're looking for how they... My two-year-old at the moment, just, you know, she's constantly checking in with me or Allegra, and she's always looking to see what we think, how we perceive what she's doing, and she's just processing and learning that shit. And yet our entire world, through from the way architecture projects are done to the, our school curriculum, to the way that our businesses are structured, is all structured in a completely different way, which is that it assumes that we learn through instruction and knowledge rather than learning through experience.
And also that there is a right thing or a right answer.
Absolutely, exactly, yeah. That like, there is a, and that's a massive hierarchy in itself, because it's the answers are in the back of the book. And don't look, because that would be cheating, as Ken Robinson says on his amazing Do Schools Kill Creativity video. It's just, yeah, whereas actually I passionately believe, you know, whether you're somebody who's coming to a cultural organisation or you're going to school, the thing that is exciting is the opportunity to think about the way that you're going to do something. And I just passionately believe that that defines ultimately who you, much more about who you are than just the knowledge you have.
Yeah, especially because, I mean, I remember it's like I was at a really, you know, my school really valued kind of really valued achievement and the thing at prize giving, the book token or whatever. And I remember like it was really tough when I entered the actual world and was like, no one gives a shit that I came second in like geography. That's not a useful life skill. And it's much more useful to know how to fail and be resilient in that.
One of the other things we nicked from Brazil, I think a lot of my ideas have been that we've done here or have been nicked from Brazil. One of them is a thing called the Agency, which is this program which is about Faustini grew up in a favela in Rio and is a theatre director, and recognised that when the favelas were being pacified, that mobile phones stores were popping up on street corners and young people were being given jobs selling mobile phones. And part of that's kind of, one might say, is positive, because the favelas are more safer zones and therefore young people are being given jobs. In another way, it's really depressing because young people are being given jobs in the kind of bottom rung of a ladder of a very existing paradigm. And so his thought was, well, how, if we're going to reshape favelas, then how do the members, how do the youngest members of our community then help to reshape them? So he took his theatre directing process, which involves failure and metaphor and creativity and scratch and all, you know, all of those sorts of things that artists so brilliantly use. And he helped young people set up their own businesses and social enterprises. And we, with
which
Contact,
you do, here.
Yeah, we contact in Manchester, and it's growing now in Belfast and Cardiff and other places too, because it's basically a creative process through which those young people, for us living around Winstanley Estate behind Clapham Junction, set up and run their own business. And every time I meet the group every year, as kind of the artistic director, and it's a horrible moment. In fact, actually, we've stopped doing it now because we've just realised it's one of those desperately old-fashioned hierarchical moments where, you know, the group comes in and meets the artistic director. And I just always come out of that meeting and go, it's not going to work. It's absolutely not going to work, because this group is just, there's just such a low level of engagement, a low level of conversation, a kind of real...
But it's the structure that creates that.
But this, yeah, but then 12 weeks later, they've gone through this process and they are positive and they are... incredibly engaged with their own idea to the level of obsession. But what's really interesting, I think, about the agency is when you look back at the 28 projects that have happened so far in Manchester and Battersea, 24 of them are still going, and this is over like 5 or 6 year period.
Wow.
The start-up businesses are...
That's remarkable.
It's nuts. It's just like... Yeah. And I don't think that's because... I don't think that's anything other than because it's a creative process, and through creativity you do build an inner resilience, because a creative process has to be a resilient one, because you know, you know, Grayson Perry has creativity, our mistakes or whatever, his bin, because he knows that when he lobs a pot in the bin, that's where the learning is and that's where the creativity is. And so there's some, the reason why those projects are still going is because those young people know that it's never going to end. They have to, you know, it's not going to be this thing where you suddenly get to a perfect point of a product and it's made and it's finished, da-da, and everyone's going to pat you on the back.
And also it's about the quest.
Yeah, completely. I totally agree. And that's addictive in itself, because the quest becomes meeting people. The quest becomes growing an idea. The quest becomes... And actually, it's quite linked to sort of, you know, ideas around entrepreneurialism and people being entrepreneurial, that sort of creative sense. And yet, as I say, our companies and our I mean, some companies are, but on the whole, you know, lots of our arts organisations are still structured as if they're 19th century manufacturing industries.
Yeah.
You know, fixed departments. You know, I mean, not like manufacturing industries these days, which are much more fluid, but actually ones that were making cars in 1900.
Or, yeah, like the, like, you know, I'm from a family of people who worked in cotton mills, and it's it very much feels like that. I like, as an artist, when I go into those big like regional, that's not fair, there could be monoliths whether in the regions or not, but
there's plenty of them in London.
Yeah, right? I know, those big monoliths, and I always like, there's a bit of me that does feel like I'm going to the the factory, and and they care about me about as much as if I was about to have my arm ripped off by a loom. Like the sense of well-being and responsibility and shared ownership of the world.
Well, I think there's something about what happens when you create departments, silos. You also create tribes in that moment, and you create barriers, and so you actually, you know, you encourage people to think territorially. And I'm not saying that departmental models don't work, and because there are amazing, brilliant people who run those systems, but just in general, when you create those sorts of structures, one of the things I noticed here quite quickly is we used to have a senior management team, 7 departments, production, producing, marketing, fundraising, finance, and so on, that actually they were like little companies, and they behaved, they were encouraged, we, Battersea Arts Centre, encouraged them to behave in this slightly tribal way, where they would protect their own resources. Even the way that we put our plan together for the year, you wouldn't put necessarily your plan together, you would have a vision and you'd have, you know, artists and shows, but if you look under the cover of the business plan of a lot of those organisations, it's based around the functions of the organisation, and you just think, why are we not focused more on what the goal is of what we're actually trying to do? You know, why aren't our plans actually focused on what we're trying to achieve? All these functions that we all have, we're all administrators of one kind or another, that we're here to facilitate and support. So it's, for me, it's just been that's been part of the journey as well, of unlocking this organisation at the time, has been trying to find another fluid way. We work with this brilliant woman. When David Mitchell and I worked together as joint artistic directors, we worked with Sarah Priest, who's now at Mountview, and she had this idea of project working, because she'd worked in there, she'd gone off on a claw placement into the commercial sector, worked in Mother Advertising and Unilever, and she basically had this inspirational idea and scratched it in the organisation, and we set up project working, which now we still have our teams, but they don't run the ship.
Yeah.
You know, there's 20, 25 projects in the organisation at any one time. Those projects have a shaper and a project manager and a team of 2 or 20, depending on the size of the project. So it's more like a matrix that everybody sort of moves around.
Mm-hmm.
It's more creative. It's more actually how I think when you look about, you know, how artists work, it's a much more sort of fluid and flexible way. But it still has structure. There's still clarity and accountability, but it just enables...
And it means you have to... You know, it means you have to solve problems. I have worked in the odd fucked up organisation with weird silo-fied departments. I have done that in all sorts of sectors. And that's the thing. Like, the thing stops working at the point at which you don't have to address the fact that you just bloody hate that guy. You know, and actually, if you have to work with that guy that you bloody hate on 3 projects out of 12 in a year, you sort it out.
Yeah, completely.
And I think there's something about giving people the responsibility to do that.
Yeah, and giving people the opportunity to have multiple identities.
Mm.
Because the job in the line of management in the department, it's very hard to have anything other than that one personality.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's not fair on anyone. We all deserve to have multiple personalities. And we also all deserve to have multiple identities so that we can behave differently at different times. So that's the other thing that it enables. It just enables people to bring out different sides of themselves at different times and learn new skills as well. Like, you know, we have people now in the team who, you know, they might start with their marketing, but then they'll do some fundraising, or then they'll look at thinking about doing some producing. And so it just encourages that sort of bit more of a fluid approach.
And also, like, in, you know, in the making of art, like, no one ever just does their job.
Mm.
That, I mean, the idea that there is just a job. Like, that's when I was working in the States, someone got told off for for sorting something out on the stage because it's the, you know, they weren't unionized, and, and I was like, I mean, please, can they just let them sort it out? It just needs sorting out.
And I think that's, I mean, I, the stuff that we've done with the organization here comes from artists, because it comes from, you know, devised practice. We do generally devised ensemble based practice here, which again has less of a hierarchy than a more conventional approach where somebody writes a script and then a director is commissioned to, you know, and then they build a team, and then there are more structures, and I'm not knocking that, it's just,
because I do that sometimes, so I'm not allowed to knock that.
Knocking it, it's not my kind of theatre personally, but because I prefer, what I like about the more kind of generally the more open devised processes, I do think it leaves a, I think just on statistical evidence you would say it leaves a more open relationship with the audience. Often there is a more open and playful relationship with the audience. The audience recognises that it's there, you know, that there isn't a fourth wall, that you have some agency, some element of agency as an audience member in I think in more of that work than you do in work that is made through a more conventional process. That's what I would argue.
So I'm just going to rephrase the questions to one that you're a bit more comfortable with, because we hate legacy, we hate the idea of that. That's part of what these are about, because I think I make theatre, I do this because I want to leave the world changed. I hope that that's for the better. Every now and then I have psychotic moments, and maybe it's really not. But theoretically, it's towards whatever the good is. I was just curious, like, what without centering your ego, which I know you're not comfortable with. What do you want to leave changed?
I think the opportunity for people to, because for me it's not really about the program or the building or the activity in terms of this organisation. It's about the opportunity for people to keep feeling like they can change. Because in terms of your point, I love your thought around the good, you know, the idea of the good. What is the good? Because clearly one person's good is another person's nightmare. And for me, that again, that's not really the point. Is to try and kind of find a shared good. Is to just try and find a shared process by which people can find their own good, or their own community's good, or their own family's good, or their own relationships good, or their own parent sibling, you know, parent child relationship. So for me, I think it's about, that sounds all very waffly, doesn't it? But it's about how. Yeah, it goes back to Bananarama. It feels like if we could just all remember Bananarama a bit more every day and think that it is about the way we do things. It is about the way that we have our relationships. It is about the way we conduct ourselves, the way we say something, the way we create something, the way we make something. I think if we all thought more about the way we did things, and we, then I think we would quite quickly get into situations where we lived more creatively and more openly and in a kind of richer way, because I think we would be thinking about another person. Because as soon as you think about the way you do something, you have to think about the other person.
Yeah.
Whereas the moment you're just thinking about getting the geography certificate, or you're thinking about getting the best show or getting the, then actually sometimes other people do get in the way.
Yeah.
They get in your way. Whereas actually when you're thinking about the way you're going to do something, then actually people are important then, because they're the people that you're going to make something with, you're going to do something with. So I just think the world, maybe it sounds like highfalutin bullshit, but I just think the world might just be a bit gentler and kinder if we did think more about the way we did stuff, because we would constantly be having to think about each other rather than the sort of, you know, the human achievement. It's interesting thinking, I was talking to some doctor in the NHS the other day about how within the NHS there's a sort of, you know, fear of exposing failure, and that culture can actually lead to a very negative sense of people, you know, the paper in the Lancet or whatever is the thing that you have got to get, and the problem, you know, because money follows, you know, reputation follows, all of that follows. But of course what that, it's interesting, just talking to this doctor was saying that actually that means that there's all sorts of bad research that's been created and published which hasn't always been challenged, or indeed even within departments, he was saying that you know, because there is a culture within the department of the sort of the kind of consultant surgeon or whatever having this sort of absolute sort of control hierarchy and everybody else feeding into that, that there's a lack of question, there's a lack of doubt, there's a lack of. And I'm sure this is not true in all NHS departments.
But there's no space to question that the dictator, essentially.
And the hierarchy, and the achievement, and the idea of getting in the Lancet. And so I feel like, and this is beginning to become part of our political discourse, isn't it, in terms of recognising that within the health service, for example, there has to be a greater vulnerability. There has to be, you know, and you look at the terrible things that have happened sometimes in the NHS. Actually, you look frankly at some of the terrible things that have happened in the arts and the creative industries.
Yeah.
And you look at the hierarchies that
it always comes from
moments.
Not being able to own up.
Yeah. And not being able to articulate or not having a voice or not being able to express. I'm generalising obviously massively, but yeah, not being able to kind of fully articulate something that is happening. And again, I just think if there was more conversation about the way we did something, and we're learning this constantly in the organisation, particularly as we work more and more in different areas and different projects, just thinking about how do we constantly get better about the way we think about how we do something, and the structures and the support that people need to think about that, and the thing, and you know, when material or show triggers things for people, how do you then support people in that moment too? So, you know, you're not just always thinking about the kind of product and the thing you're trying to make, and you're trying to get 5 stars or an award or whatever, all of that side of things. How can you actually support people to think about the thing that they're doing now and what that means?
And so it's about the quest. Yeah. Like, it's the journey, not the fleece or whatever.
Which actually is the fleece. You know, that's the reward. It goes back to the thing we were saying earlier about people, you know, giving presents. That actually is the thing.
I'm finding that interesting. I'm thinking some new things. Because I've been really struggling, like, this last probably year. Because I feel like I spend a lot of time with people saying, what's the solution to? Why? How can the arts be more diverse? How can it be more... how can it be kinder?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's just felt so impossible. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the world's a mess. Like, it's a complete mess. Or it feels like it. And the structures are wrong, and the goals are wrong, and there isn't space for it to be something else. Or it feels like it. And so I found myself talking to someone the other day who was genuinely asking me for my thoughts on how they could put in place a programme or a structure within an umbrella organisation for musical theatre that would mean that people from working class backgrounds could do musical theatre in a way that they can't at the moment. And my answer was, well, actually, I think there should be an environmental cataclysm that kills 2/3 of humanity, and then we rebuild all the structures from scratch. And I was like, that maybe killing off 2/3 of the world isn't actually a solution, Rebecca. So I was probably being too goal-oriented, right? Maybe I should think about the way...
Yeah, that's a really good definition of... people getting in the way.
Yeah. I have this really bad habit of thinking about the massive macro level. And so when someone says to me, how can I stop people dropping litter on Brixton High Street, I'm like, well, kill 2/3 of humanity. because in my head I'm going through, you know, the capitalist structure and the value that people place on themselves and their environment, and all of that's about money and blah 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 blah.
It's going to be a very disturbing final episode of the Legacy Tapes
where I kill everybody. Yeah, I'm not actually going to do that. And it's really kind of, you know, it's so objectivist and horrible to think like that. that sense of like maybe the getting everything right isn't the right thing. It's the attempt with kindness and generosity. And I do know that, but it's really hard to remember
it. It's really hard because the whole system's against us, isn't it? In terms of if you...
Yes, which is why we need to kill two-thirds of humanity.
I think you then become the system. I think there's that Margaret Mead quote about only it was only there's only a small... I can't never remember exactly what she said. She did it very beautifully, but the... to change the world or something, a small group of people came together and thought carefully or something and made change happen in it, and it never thus. And that's, I suppose, the maybe that's the sort of slightly redeeming thought instead of a murderous rampage, is just thinking about... It is incredible now, actually, how change can happen so quickly, I think. And it's really exciting, I think, to think of... I mean, people always use the example of sort of... smoking and how quickly that changed, you know, in just a moment. And for me, I just think, just thinking about, even though the things that happen in this building, this organisation, don't stop people dropping litter on Brixton High Street or indeed necessarily anywhere else. I just think that the moments of transformation. I just think it's interesting when you think about the way people responded to the Grand Hall actually when it burnt down, and that's sort of very. I've constantly questioned myself about why that reaction...
Because there was a massive swell.
Why was that so strong? Why was that such a powerful thing? And indeed, actually, when other buildings like this have gone down, or unfortunately the Grand Hall obviously was still... It's kind of... It heroically managed to somehow still stand up and keep its walls there, which we've been able to build around. But what is that response? And I keep coming back to the fact that hundreds and thousands of people have got married in this building. Hundreds of thousands of people have had moments in the theatre in this building which have kind of made them go, oh my God, that's shit, or oh my God, that's incredible, or oh, I'm thinking something new, or hundreds of thousands of people have, you know, come to workshops in this building where they've had moments of transformation. I just isn't surely that's it. Surely it's that
hundreds and thousands of people have left changed.
Yeah, exactly, and made change, and surely that means that the bricks and mortar stand then for something more than the bricks and mortar. They stand for those moments of transformation. They stand for those moments of change. I always think it's quite spooky how many people in buildings like this. I mean, I'm obviously most familiar with this building, but I think in buildings like this. Have kind of had moments of extraordinary collision in life, which have often led to marriage or have often led to long-term partnerships. Extraordinarily, on the night of the fire, and I only found this out last week, somebody wrote to me saying that they had met their partner here when they were working here in the in a basement studio, when Grace and Perry had a basement studio here, and they knew Grayson, and they got together with their partner. And they'd since, I think, separated, but their partner had then died. And they were, there was a whole network of them, about 10 friends who used to sort of hang out.
Yeah.
And they all stood next to it. And they were all driving here on the night of the fire just to have a moment all together, just a sort of reunion. And that happens lots here. You have these moments where people gather. And, of course, then they were all texting each other, like on their way here, saying, it's on fire, what are we going to do? Unless we all went down to the Southbank Centre and met down there. but now they're going to hopefully come back. But it's really interesting to think about the number of sort of lifelong change or partnerships that have happened in this building. And I just think that's so. Yeah, I suppose I'm slightly rambling, but going back to your point about sort of macro to micro, it's just worth thinking about, I suppose, how those micro moments of change just do lead.
Yeah, and they add up, and I'm bored of myself saying it, but society is woven from the stories that we tell about it.
Yeah.
So you just have to keep telling the stories in increments, and it'll be different.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important that places like this do break down their hierarchies, and we've still got lots of them. We've still got lots of work to do to break down those hierarchies, but because the trouble is, it's whose stories. You know, the whole Western canon of art is made up of stories by men who are white and middle class, and or whatever the equivalent. And it's so all of those stories. I heard Duke Kelly say this the other day, are just reaffirming, you know, the same stories all the time.
Yeah.
So we have got to tell different stories, and that doesn't always mean, I think, necessarily. You know, trying to, because I think it doesn't necessarily always mean trying to kind of encourage people to make shows. You should come and make a show about your story in this building. It's about recognising that everybody is creative in a different way. And I think the journey to becoming an artist is a lifelong journey, but even to becoming a professional artist is often a long one. And there's lots of things that you can do along the way as you make that journey. That's why the agency, so again, is so important to us as a as an idea for the program here, is because it's about bringing young people who never walked into this building or never saw it as a place that was theirs or for them, and now who hang out in here in the office with all of my team and who have memberships in the Scratch Hub at the back of the building and who create and make things here, and who, you know, Vendors Mechanics has a bicycle workshop outside the front of the building on a regular basis, and all of those sorts of businesses and projects that are happening, they are ways into expressing your own identity and expressing what it is you
which
want
is
to
another
make,
kind of story
which is another kind of story and so then it's about, and then it's about those people then being able to become more stronger and more confident and frankly more visible, so that then their stories become ever more told. And I think that's the job of culture anywhere. And again, from Brazil, it's why, you know, Brazil in this country, as I've said several times before, but, you know, people think of culture as something you do at 7:30 in the evening with a glass of wine in your hand, and that's a fucked up interpretation of what culture is.
Yeah.
Actually, culture is your family, it's your street,
it's everything.
It's your everything. It's the way that your stories are told. And Brazil has so much more of a, I think, anyway, I don't want to kind of, you know, romanticise about a foreign country and be down on this country, but I do think the hierarchy in this country is so buggered up in terms of some of that stuff. There is so much we have to smash down, and you can see why things like Brexit have absolutely happened, and it makes, you know, it's a completely rational, logical path as to why that's happened.
Yes, of course.
And I think if our culture wasn't so... wasn't so fucked up, then I don't, you know, I think that those voices would be heard. And
yeah,
and
because it was like the not hearing
of
so many people for
millions.
So long.
Yeah. And that's not just about politics, that's about
arts, it's everything.
Places, it's about our education spaces, it's about our elite universities, it's about, so, and that's why it's so important that we change. We change in the context of this organisation. We change what we do. You know, going back to right to the beginning of this conversation, three black box spaces, and three theatres which can have the main programme as part of them, and everyone goes to see it and goes, "Oh, that's the main programme. That ideology, that orthodoxy, that set of values, that set of beliefs, that programme.
That's the one that's valued.
That's what I need to strive to become." Yeah. And if you just don't see yourself there, then why would you strive to? Because it's just not. And then, you know,
well, you're just going to like mess yourself up trying.
Yeah, yeah. And if you multiply that hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times of venues across the country, you've got a problem. And that's why it's so important to then recalibrate that whole structure, so that actually people are using these buildings, as you said, to tell different kinds of stories. And then that will take time, but over 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, that's a revolution. It's just a slow one.
Yeah, but you've been here for that.
It's been a slow one. It's been a slow one in this organisation. It has, and I think it's still, you know,
still going
long beyond when I've left here. I hope it's you know, it's still going.
So we're sort of, I should stop talking to you shortly. I'm going to ask you two questions. One is, can you tell me about a thing? Maybe it was a piece of art, but maybe it wasn't. A thing that has changed you, has marked you somehow.
Yes. My bike, when it broke, came into my mind as I cycled down Pall Mall to get to Battersea one day. I think the thing that also sprang to mind, which is that there's a young man called Seshi Henry who lives on my Stanley estate, and was connected to this organisation when he was sort of 13, 14, and he came to... in some of our kind of part of our early beatbox academy when we ran that, and I said to him one day, Seshi, you've got to come and see this artist, you've got to come see the show, it's really great. It's in the council chamber, I'll get you in for free, tell me what you think of it. And I remember going in at the balcony on the gallery in the council chamber, and I remember watching. When I watch shows, I usually watch the audiences. Obviously, if I've seen the show,
Me too. When it's your job,
yeah, exactly. So I just watched Seshi, And it wasn't a long watch because he was asleep in 5 minutes. And this was one of my favourite artists, I'm not sure who it was, but it's just like, you know, artist who I think is absolutely sort of exceptional and sensational. Mm. And it was a moment that marked me simply because it was just a really bloody obvious slap in the face of what I liked wasn't necessarily what Sessie was going to like.
Yeah.
And these buildings are designed on a model of artistic direction, which is that I choose and you join.
Mm.
You know, come and join in. Even if it's like, you know, certainly on the basis of shows, I'll put on the shows, I'm the tastemaker, and you come and see my taste. And I'm not criticising that as a fundamental, you know, act, but I am. But when you do the macro thing and you look at what that means more widely, there's a big problem. But equally, it's the model that follows in terms of participation, in that we constantly invite young people to participate, or anybody at any stage of life to participate in our organisations, and we say to them, you know, we're a theatre, come and act, we're an orchestra, come and play, we're a gallery, come and paint, and actually also come and paint alongside this exhibition of this artist that I've put on at the moment,
or
come and act with this artist who I've put on at the moment. And we then wonder why.
Come and replicate our fucked up colonialist hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Come and enjoy our self perpetuating cycle of more and more white middle class people running organisations and setting the taste and setting the culture and setting the. So the moment for me with Sessie was important because it made me recognise that, you know. The ego of mine to think that immediately that Sessie was going to have this moment in the theatre where he was going to be, you know, he was going to just fall in love with this artist. Just, I mean, it sucks. It really sucks. And so when it comes back to the agency again, but then when the agency started, we invited Sessie to take part in it, and he quite quickly had an idea that he wanted to set up this thing called Island Next, which was a positive music platform for artists, and he hosted an event in the Lower Hall, which is now the Scratch Hub. This was back in about 2014, and he invited an artist called Stormzy to come and perform, and this was before.
Oh, I think I've heard of him.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing.
Yeah.
We've heard of him now.
No.
I hadn't heard of him then. I didn't know who he was. I didn't, and also I'm telling you this story. I don't remember Stormzy being here at all. It's just, you know, three or four years later, somebody said, you know who's in the Lower Hall? I'm like, what? And so Sessie has now, you know, with I Am Next, he's doing a night as part of the Phoenix season in February. He's pulls in artists from all over the world. He's taken I Am Next to Amsterdam. He's developing I Am Next as all sorts of sort of digital things he's doing. And he's amazing, and he's incredible, and it inspires me to look at him and to look at the fire in his belly and the passion when he talks about it. And there was me trying to get him to watch that show, and I just think it is interesting when you think about how cultural organisations can. It goes back to process, because we have this extraordinary opportunity, which is that we are saying as cultural spaces we're good at creative process. We're good at, you know, if we're not good at creativity, we really should pack up and shut up shop, but we're good at creative process. So why aren't we saying to people, come and be creative, use this process that we can share, and obviously you've got your own creativity, everybody has creativity on tap, you can tap
come
into
and be
yours.
You
come and be you, come and express your
and
identity.
You know how to do that in a way we don't
and the thing that we can provide is, and I think this is where Scratch is such an important thing, that recognition that we shifted from using Scratch just in theatre spaces to be able to use Scratch for architecture, to be able to use Scratch to help young people develop their businesses, is that is a process by which enables anybody who has an idea to test it, to hear what other people say, and it has its own critical system and structure within it, which enables people to develop something. Because there's all this bullshit talks about excellence in the arts, and, you know, high quality, and who's excellence and who's high quality,
who is the arbiter?
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, when you develop something through Scratch, it's the community with which you develop that idea, and community, you know, everybody is savvy. Everyone can say what they when they think something is good or not good, or how you might develop it, or how you might shape it. So Sessie developed Next through that Scratch process, through, you know, and he learned a lot, and he got lots of feedback, and also, as well as, you know, a community response, part of that community is the police, and he has to think about his events in terms of the police and how they work, and he's developed relationships with local police forces, and it's just really inspiring just to watch him, you know, his whole world come alive through his through the articulation and the development of his vision, through testing it, through trying it, through doing it, not through reading it in a book, not through being sat down in a theatre, by me and say, watch this, you'll like this.
And
this
not by trying to do someone else's version of it.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, by doing his version. And that goes right back to process, because it goes back to people being empowered to be the best that they could be. It comes back to process.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was first trying to be a director, I used to really struggle because everyone was telling me I should be assistant directing. And I was like, and everyone that I assistant directed for, it was them. I could never be like that. And probably wouldn't want to be a lot of them. And I really struggled until in the end I was like, well, fuck this shit. Like, if I can't, you know, if I can't find my voice myself, then I should shut up. That was my... I'm meaner to myself than I am to other people.
And move into your own thing. Move into your own...
Yeah, whatever that is.
Yeah. And find the people who want to be there too.
Yeah. So last one, which is... and I ask everyone, and you're not in any way dying, because this is a legacy conversation. But you might be. God, I'm so sorry if I just put my foot in it. That'd be awful. Oh, and in like 6 months, it's announced. Let's hope not.
Yeah.
In many, many years, right, when you have gone from this place, and there is a grizzled old person who was once part of the agency, and someone says, who is David Jubb, or what was that, what would you like them to say?
Oh god, I've absolutely no idea. There's just something about assisting and serving and supporting that I believe quite passionately in, just the notion of being somebody. It's so funny, isn't it? There's that brilliant song I remember in what's it called? Was that album? Bugger, I can't remember it.
Was it by Banana Rama?
Jamie Catto.
Okay.
Do you know Jamie Catto? He was like, basically, they did this album, they went around the world and they did lots of interviews, and they interviewed lots of kind of like sort of wise old geezers, and somebody said something about, you know, when at the end of your life, nobody ever says, I wished I had... this is sounding like fucking gloomy legacy.
Do it, go on.
That nobody ever said, I wished I'd made that extra deal. I wish I'd made that extra project. Wish I'd made that extra... But everybody says, I wish I'd spent more time with my family. I wish I'd spent more time with friends. I wish I'd made more of those connections. And so I suppose my answer to your question is, when people look back and they're having that moment, I would just hope that they would remember that I was one of the people that helped and didn't get in the way, because there's a lot of us that get in the way, and I get in the way, so I'm very conscious that sometimes I cock up during a day and I think, shit, I've got that wrong, I've just been unhelpful, I've just not helped that.
But that's okay, you recognise it, so you can go back and...
Well, but I suppose, but that's what I would just hope, is that somebody went, oh yeah, they were...
It was really helpful.
That was quite helpful, yeah.
Nice. Good. All right. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
I feel like I should say for the record that I do not want to personally murder 2/3 of humanity. I was just suggesting that if there was an environmental disaster, it might be good for the green agenda. anyway, thank you so much, David. Thanks
nice
a lot.
To talk to you.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.